Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Where are we?
We're at the Greenwich Observatory, looking out over the best view in London.
And who are you?
I'm Ned Bolting, and I am a cycling broadcaster and writer.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
So what's the plan, Ned?
Well, we're going to... I live about a mile from here, so this isn't normally my starting point, but this is by far my most regular ride. This is my home road. This is basically how to get in from southeast London into the centre of town, mostly on what is now known as Quiet Way 1, which is pretty quiet, actually, and takes you through kind of ragged hodgepodge of a route through some fascinating parts of by far the best corner of London, which is southeast London. But you know that.
I'm not sure I do know that.
Yes, you do. You haven't admitted it to yourself, that's all.
The thing is, mate, I only ever come to this part of London when I'm running marathons.
Here we go.
You know, the rest of the time...
Well, right where we are now is exactly where everyone lines up, isn't it?
It is.
To get out of that gate and onto Blackheath.
It really is, but I'm a bit rusty on the old running front, so it'll be good to just do it on a bike for once.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the start point of, you know, the centrepiece of the view that we're just leaving behind us now of the Isle of Dogs and the sweep of the River Thames and Canary Wharf,
yeah,
just the other side. But the kind of jewel in the crown in Greenwich Park is the Queen's House, which was built for Queen Anne in the early 17th century.
Yeah.
A really important building built by Inigo Jones. And I thought that'd be quite a nice start point. And I vaguely got in mind that once we get into town, we could probably just finish off outside the present Queen's House, Buckingham Palace.
I love that. You've thought about this.
Totally.
You've given this more thought than any other guest before.
But this is a great excuse just to poodle around London.
Which is
almost my most favourite thing in the world. You know how, like, people when they're interviewed say, yeah, the best moment of my life was the birth of my children, because they kind of have to say that,
yeah,
right? Some of the best moments of my life are, if I'm perfectly honest, just pootling around London.
Same thing. I mean, getting to you this morning across London from where I live in the north, across the city, came over London Bridge, and even though the traffic was abysmal and it was gridlock and I was having to weave through buses and past taxis in the city, I was still thinking, I just love London, and this is always the best way to see it, is on a bicycle.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I mean, in some ways, you know, I suppose your podcast listeners, to some extent, Matt, are going to be the initiated and, you know, the sort of people who wouldn't bat an eyelid about riding around London. But the people I actually want to access, if I could only find a way of doing it, are those people who are wavering or hesitating on the brink of riding around London.
Yeah.
Getting out of the buses and the tube and, or even, God forbid, the car, we're going left here. But who are still put off by the amount of traffic. And I just love to get the message out that, as you're going to see, like in the 8 miles ahead of us,
yeah,
we're barely going to see a car.
Good, really?
You know, we are going to be so off-piste. This is one of the very few points where we're actually mixing with the traffic.
This is great.
It's remarkable.
This is quite an unusual one then for home roads, because, well, you know, anything goes. People's home roads are different depending on how they ride and what they do. But
yeah,
I haven't done a cross-city urban amble yet. So I'm really looking forward to it. And seeing it from your point of view, I mean, I know my routes around town when I'm on the bike.
Yeah.
But
yeah, well, London's very tribal and territorial, isn't it?
It is.
So, you know, we don't understand how each other's, and left, is it? Yeah, let's left down here. We don't understand how each other's little patches of the city work that we live in.
That's the beauty of the place, yeah. Isn't it? That it is, you do recognise when you're on the bike how these are all villages and then towns that have merged together, to form what I think is the greatest city in the world. Yeah. And it's not planned, it's so organic.
Yeah. Which is part of the problem that I think cycling activists and people have in designing some sort of coherent structure for a cycling network. The fact that it is, I mean, look at this road we've just suddenly come onto now. This must be a kind of like, possibly kind of 17th century road originally, you know?
Yes.
And it's just, you know, it's very narrow, tiny little cottages on either side, just off Greenwich Town Centre.
And a tube train going past at the end of the road,
going,
or is it,
you know,
overground, yeah.
So it's kind of like, it's quite hard to... Sometimes it's quite hard to see where you're going to build these big segregated highways for, you know, that really will keep cyclists separate from road traffic. It isn't going to be possible everywhere, even in the best utopian ideals. So I think one of the many kind of policies you can introduce is marking out these quiet routes. And right now we're about to hit Quiet Way 1, which is the most successful route, I think, in terms of uptake and participation that London's actually come up with so far.
Are you from London, Ned?
No, I feel like I am. I spent all my adult life in London. I left home when I was 17 and went to live in Germany for a little bit. Then went to university and messed around in Germany for a few more years. But as soon as that adventure was over, I settled in London, and that's a long time ago.
Why Germany in particular?
I had a place at university to read modern languages, and I kind of deferred by a year, so I had a year out. I just happened to do all right in A-levels, right? Yeah. I had no kind of multilingual, bilingual upbringing. I'd barely been abroad. And suddenly realised I didn't actually know how to speak either French or German. So I sort of panicked and got myself over there. Because the only way to really acquire foreign languages is to immerse yourself in them and in the culture, I think.
Yes.
And so I fell in love with Germany and still feel very, very fond of the place and kind of drawn to it as a culture. This is so good, showing one Londoner around your part of London, actually. I don't often get to do this.
It's great. Well, it feels like a bit of a privilege to have this, you know, insight into these back roads.
So it's incredibly industrial around here, the river, and always has been, right? So this is Deptford that we're riding into now. And it's kind of between Greenwich and Deptford is marked by this little river.
What's this? It's
very tidal. This is Deptford Creek. You see that building there with all the kind of rainbow-coloured cladding?
Yeah.
That's a famous dance school, the Le Ban Conservatoire.
Oh, I've heard of it. Let me get a picture of you with it.
So Deptford Creek there, which is incredibly tight. So when the tide's in at the moment, when the tide comes out, it's just mud banks. It's one of those.
You know? So where did you grow up then before you headed off to do modern languages?
So this is going to be a conversation killer because you're simply not going to know what to say after I tell you. Bedford.
Yeah, Bedford.
That's
good. Don't really know too much about Bedford.
There you go. That's it.
Happy childhood?
Well, yeah. Yeah, it was. It was a long time ago, but it was great. You know, I had a bike, Valley Olympus. My dad bought it for me when I was about 12 from a small ad in the Bedfordshire on Sunday, and I remember really well. I remember going to the bloke's back garden. He got out of a shed. He was selling it.
Yeah.
And saying, "Yeah, it's been on the Tour de France, this bike." It was used on the Tour de France. And neither Dad nor I had the faintest idea how to judge whether or not he was... We didn't really know what the Tour de France was, because no one really knew what the Tour de France was back then, except for those people, those very few people who knew about it.
Yeah. Oh, the irony. Oh, the irony of that.
That's incredible.
Several decades later, and you are Mr. Tour de France.
So we kind of stared at this bike and kind of like... We were pretty impressed, actually, if truth be told.
Yeah.
You know? We didn't know what it meant, but we knew it was pretty cool. Yeah.
Was it like my childhood bike, in that your dad bought it several sizes too big and you'll grow into this, son.
Yeah,
and by the time you're 19, you still haven't grown into it. It's still too big.
Well, I'm still a short ass, and I don't think I ever grew into it. I think I took it off to university with me eventually and didn't lock it up one time outside the pub, and that was that, you know.
That's heartbreaking.
I had one of those feeble little combination locks with the plasticky bit in the chain, and it just got cut.
Yeah, rubbish.
And anyway, so that was kind of the end of cycling and me. For probably 22 years or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? I think I was the same. I think all kids get into
it. Follow the stream of cyclists and that. They're all going the same way, mate.
All kids get into it and do it, don't they? I was exactly the same, and it was all rally bikes when I was a kid. You know, it was rally BMXs. Andy Ruffell was my hero, you know, the BMXer.
Right, yeah,
in
yeah,
the
yeah,
80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the classic white rally with the red, blue, and yellow trim, if you like, the paint job. I actually saw one on an old school one on the way over this morning, it just takes you straight back to lusting after those kind of bikes. But same thing, I sort of forgot why I loved cycling once I got to university. No one cycled for transport then.
No, absolutely not.
And then it was only until I was sort of early 30s, a runner by that point, well, runner of sorts, and I hired a bike on a trip to New York. I was there for work on my own, single speed.
Yeah.
And it was utterly revelatory. Why the hell aren't I doing this in London? You know?
Yeah.
And that was it then.
Yeah.
But I'd always enjoyed watching the Tour.
Yeah.
Remember vividly Stephen Roach winning in 87, because I think in Britain it was treated like almost like a home success.
Yeah, yeah.
He was Irish. Was that the case with you? Did you always enjoy watching the racing, even though perhaps you didn't do it yourself?
No, not at all. I mean, I only very occasionally did the concept of racing a bicycle punch through. And I remember hearing and reading about Roach's win, but I didn't understand it. Certainly hadn't watched any of it on Channel 4. I mean, I just wasn't interested. It didn't. I was a football fan, you know.
Yeah.
And honestly, Matt, I mean, people kind of blows their mind sometimes when they hear this, but I'd never seen or any kind of bike race, whether on the TV or for real, until I went to the prologue of the 2003 Tour de France for ITV and watched David Miller dropping his chain and making a mess of it all. And that was my introduction. But I mean, what an introduction. It was kind of almost instantly I was totally enraptured by it. You know, I didn't understand it.
No.
It took 4 or 5 years until I even felt straight over here, but just a bit careful because there's cars. It took years before I felt confident enough to express any kind of opinion or really kind of claim to be on top of the subject matter. I think you had to approach it. You have to approach every sport with humility, but I think cycling perhaps more than any other, because it's such a complex code, that road racing in particular, even now I'm still trying hard to crack, you know.
I think that's incredibly humble of you, and I think everybody who listens to you commentate, has seen your reports on the races, seen your interaction with the pros, read your books, know that you're absolutely about that. I mean, who else would admit they called it the yellow jumper for ages before being corrected and it's been called the yellow jersey, and then call that the title of a book? It's very open and honest. Did you feel that? Did you feel like an outsider that you just had to say, look, this is new to me and I'm going to figure it out, but I love it?
I think I did, Matt, and I think it was a risk, actually. With the benefit of hindsight, I think it's paid off to a certain extent, but I did feel left here. I did feel, I would have felt uncomfortable trying to fudge it and make out like I was one of the initiated, because anyone who was initiated would have seen through it straight away.
Yes.
You know, so a little bit of fronting up, but the reason that I think that book sold very well and continues to sell bizarrely is straight on here. It was just completely fortuitous on my part that I think a lot of people in this country in particular at precisely that point were going on the same journey as I was.
Yeah.
So it struck a chord with people. You know, a lot of people were confusing jerseys and jumpers, couldn't get their heads around why, if Mark Cavendish was the fastest in a sprint, why wasn't he winning the Tour de France?
Quite.
You know, all those, we may smirk and laugh now, but well, there's incredibly difficult, nuanced questions to kind of explain, actually, at the beginning, when you think back to your baptism in the sport. You know, this was the stuff you were asking yourself.
How many Tours de France have you done?
This will be number 16 I'm about to go and cover consecutively. It's quite a number, isn't it?
It is. And is it one of the highlights of your year?
It's the backbone of my year. It's,
yeah.
I've written books and I tour my one-man show in the autumn now.
Well, we'll talk about that in a bit, yeah.
But, I mean, all the other stuff that I kind of do and all the other commentaries and bits and pieces I do, I think they all lean on July. You know, if I think you took July away, the whole thing collapses like a teepee.
Yeah.
You know, but then, you know, in that sense, that's not dissimilar to, by the way, look at this, we're just streaming along this cycleway past all the stationary traffic. And it's great, isn't it?
It is great.
But in that sense, it's not dissimilar to the way the cycling calendar functions.
Yes.
You know? The Tour de France is just a beast that overshadows everything. And careful on this right-hand turn, because there we go, see, it's a bit blind. You know, and much as we rightly get excited, we quite rightly get excited about the classics, and we get excited about hipster races like the Bink Bank Tour, you know, the Vasdor Hagerland and all this sort of thing. And much as the Giro this year was just extraordinary and normally is.
Great.
Actually, none of them punch through in the way that the Tour de France does.
No.
You know. By the way, we've just been past Millwall Football Club. Right past Millwall Football Club by the New Den.
The New Den.
And
scary.
There's an incinerator. The massive, great big incinerator we just rode past as well. Which this is mind blowing, right? You know, Open Day London.
Yes.
Where you can just go and visit random buildings.
Yeah.
I went in there last time and I got a guided tour around the incinerator.
Brilliant.
So you know all the black bins rather than the recycling bins.
Yeah.
All the bad ones, all the naughty waste.
Yeah, yeah.
Greenwich, Southwark, Lewisham, and Westminster. That's four big boroughs.
Yeah.
All take all of their black bins to there.
And it just gets burned.
And it gets burned in these colossal furnaces. And you can see them. You get a little peepee hole thing like that. And according to, I mean, they might be spinning a good line, but virtually no kind of noxious gases get released as a process. It generates huge amounts of power for the local houses and for the national grid.
Amazing.
And results in this residue
at
the bottom that gets turned into tarmac.
Oh, great.
And I kind of think, forget it, like with the David Attenborough plasticky thing.
Yeah.
We've got to stop trying to recycle stuff.
We've
got to burn more. So we've gone from Deptford into Rotherhithe, and pretty soon we'll be in Bermondsey. And before you know it, we're only about half a mile from Tower Bridge right here.
Really?
Yep.
Tell me then about what it's like to actually work on the tour.
It's not a riot of fun all the way around. I think I'd be wrong to say that. You'll get one day in four where you're feeling a bit unaccountably flat.
Yeah.
What becomes very difficult, and I've never managed to master, is kind of keeping a mental track of where you are and what you've just witnessed over the last few days and what's coming ahead of you in the next couple of days.
Yes.
And I can hold it together for about four stages, but by about stage five, it just starts to slip through my fingers like sand.
You know? They sort of merge into one.
And if someone said, and honestly, by about stage seven or eight, and this is shocking really for a commentator, but if someone says to you, who won yesterday's stage? Often there's a 10-second reboot going on before I can answer you, because it's just too much information, you know?
You're holding so much in your head as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 190, well, slightly smaller now, the peloton, but historically 198 riders. You've got to know stuff about all of them, really. You can't, you know, it's the Tour de France, for heaven's sake. Plus all the history of it, plus the parkour, plus the race itself. I mean, like, don't forget, when we get the printed results from ASO at the end of every day, it's a pamphlet.
Yeah.
About 30 pages long. And I have a hole punch, right? And I punch them and I put them in an arch file, which is full by the, I mean, it's like a massive, it's like someone's written a PhD in cycling.
And you have your own notes on it and that
let alone that's simply the results.
Yeah.
That's the score.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like someone saying, so what was the score in a football match? Oh, it's 2-1. What was the score in the Tour de France? You drop that dossier down and go, there you go, mate, that's the score. Matt, there is a little cafe here.
Okay.
It's lovely.
Let's do it.
It's really nice. And it's very quiet where one, because
it's quiet. There's a few school kids.
Yeah.
Good coffee.
Let's do it.
You a coffee drinker?
Yep.
Good man.
Hello, good, thanks.
How may I help you?
Two flat whites, please.
Yeah,
two just drink outside if that's okay. Shall I pay you now and then?
Yeah. Thanks. That's $5.60,
please. Okay.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites.
So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What's it been like spending time with Froome? Because I know you've been down to Monaco and you've hung out with him there, and obviously you see him on the races.
Johannesburg as well, where he winters. Yeah, I spent a few days with him in Joburg a couple of years ago. He goes without saying that he's just one of the most extraordinary individuals I've ever met. I think it was very interesting spending a few days with him in the winter a couple of years ago in Joburg, because I got a sense of where he actually comes from. None of us buy the British myth, you know. Here we are sitting outside a cafe in Deptford, having a coffee. Matt, I can't see Chris Froome ever doing that. You know, these aren't his streets. This isn't his language. This isn't his culture. You know, it's been a passport of convenience, and for good reason. I don't decry that. But to see him...
Which the reason is, I mean, do you not think he's passionate about being British, or was it just a way of getting on in the sport?
Maybe I'm doing him a disservice. I know that his family heritage, both his mum and his dad, draw back on Britain, but Chris isn't Brit. Chris doesn't identify with the way we are, really, particularly, and I don't think he's got any intention of identifying.
What does he identify with most, then? Kenyan? South African?
I mean, I think it's the kind of, if you like, the Anglo diaspora in Southern Africa. Yeah. I think there are strong connections between the British background, kind of like population in Kenya, and certainly in Johannesburg. I think they share relationships across the. But you know, which isn't in any way to downplay this enormously exceptional relationship that Chris has had from being a young man with he speaks Swahili, so with Africa's black community as well, you know, to whom he reached out and received their welcome as well, and kind of like, that's an amazing story that I think often gets forgotten with Chris Froome. He really is a rider from the moon. He has come from, in cycling terms, he has come from completely outside of all Venn diagrams that have ever existed in cycling. He's the first big outsider to come and do something exceptional in the race.
A big outsider, but still a person who clearly loves cycling over racing. He's a cyclist first and foremost. You can tell he does it for the love of it rather than the cut and thrust of, you know,
the
sport.
That's a good question. I think so. I think you're right. I mean, I I've seen so many pros retire, and the minute they retire, they throw their bike in the nearest skip because it has become a toxic relationship for them. You know, it is a brutal profession, and for very few is it well remunerated. For most, it's just a poorly paid form of, you know, virtual slavery to a machine. You know, it's a nasty job. So if you're asking me, will Chris pootle around on his bike? Yeah, he might do, actually.
Back on the mountain bike,
he might do. I think he'll be back. I have this image that may prove me wrong, but whenever it comes to... whenever that moment comes where he calls it a day, I imagine Chris Froome taking his considerable chunk of money that he's earned in Europe and buying a chunk of Africa and sitting on his deck with a I hope he gets nice and chubby, you know.
I can't see it.
But with a sundowner. But looking out over kind of wildlife roaming, because he's deeply interested in wildlife. He always has been. And I think we won't see him, you know. I don't think he'll be... He won't hawk himself around, and I doubt.
An Indurain, you know, kind of champion.
Yeah, he'll be enigmatic and largely invisible and gone. Yeah. You know.
Back to riding the bike, which we will do in a second. Do you actually get to ride at all when you're away following the tour around France?
I guess a lot of people know that David Miller and I, as the commentary team, we have his Chapter 3 Brompton fold-up bikes folded away in the boot of the car. Actually, that's a lie. They're folded up and they're on the back seat of the car, falling on top of me normally. But every now and again, no, every day if we can, and it is most days, we'll get them out. And we're fortunate enough to have Christian, who drives us round as well, so he can drive the car to the finish line. David and I will look at the route, work out how much time we got until we're commentating, and actually calculate whether we can ride the last 20k of a flat stage or the last climb of a mountain stage.
It's good to recce it.
So really, really good, actually. Yeah. Enormously good. I remember the first time we did it was on stage 1 and stage 2 of the 2016 Tour de France on the Cherbourg Peninsula. And that stage that Peter Sagan won, as stage 2, was one of those really typical opening week stages with, like, little kind of like things that look like nothing on the profile, but in the last 3k it was full of little dips and ramps and little starts and turns, and if we hadn't actually ridden it, we'd have had no idea how that might have affected the race. And of course, even having ridden it, I still didn't understand, but riding it with David Miller,
yes,
he was able to say, now here, look, stop, because this is a point where you've got to do this and that, you know, this little left-hand turn is significant because of this. That kind of fine detail that only a racer can understand.
That insight's incredible, isn't it? I think the other thing that you see pros and ex-pros recognise is they can tell who's riding just by the way they're pedalling. They're so used to riding amongst other people. That's a hard thing for a non-racer to come into, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's something I think it's, as you switch from doing what you do and what I did, Matt, presenting, and you know, into commentary, which is, I think people from the outside think that they're kind of like the same mix of jobs. And then, I mean,
so then, different.
You know, it's in many ways, it's the difference between being a goalkeeper and an outfield player.
I couldn't commentate.
You're on the same pitch, but it's... Well, you don't know until you've tried it, Matt.
I'm going to try it.
But it was the first thing I had to concentrate on, I think, rider recognition.
Yeah. Who are your favourite riders? Who are your favourite people in the sport that you've come across?
As human beings?
Just for any reason.
I mean, I've always had a real soft spot for... I know, it's weird, I kind of read these things that apparently he's not so well-liked in the peloton. A lot of people are a bit fed up with him. But I've always had an enormous soft spot for Tony Martin. He's one of the first riders I kind of sat down and spoke to at length years and years ago when he was quite young, very young, about stuff in his past outside, completely separate from cycling. And I found out, to my astonishment, really, that he had a personal history that I really engaged with. He was a very young kid at the time when East Germany was falling apart. And he was one of the family... His parents took him on holiday to Hungary and ended up camping for weeks on end in the ground... Breaking into and camping for weeks on end in the grounds of the West German embassy in Budapest. And it was because of those East German families who basically applied for political asylum in West Germany, on West German territory in Hungary. They were the reason that ultimately... So much pressure was brought to bear on the East German government at the time, Erich Honecker, that it all collapsed.
Wow.
And Tony Martin was at the heart of that. And I was living in Germany at the time during reunification and when the wall came down. So I felt, and I, you know, it's a country, like as I said to you, I kind of care passionately about. So I it's very interesting to talk to him about that and about, you know, so I like Tony. In fact, I have a soft spot for almost all the German riders. I think they're wonderful guys. Fabian Wegmann,
yes.
Marcel Kittel. Down the years, they've been they've given me a lot. Yeah, and it was good to get to know at a few events recently a rider who, when he was racing, I never got to know, but now I have got to know him a little bit, and that's Jan Ullrich, who I always thought was just a sour-faced, difficult man.
Yeah.
Turns out he's an absolute bundle of laughs, and he's a great bloke.
Now the pressure's off.
Yeah.
So aside from doing the races and the other TV stuff and the writing, more recently you've come up with your one-man show on stage called Bikeology, which is, that's a bit of a departure.
Yeah, it is a bit. It's nuts, really, actually, Matt. It's absolutely nuts. It's kind of stand-up comedy, one-man show, as you say, in big theatres, and we tour in the autumn. I'm into my third year of it now.
Brilliant.
And actually, the first 2 years it was called Bikeology. This year it's going to be called Tour de Ned, which is an amazingly imaginative title. But it's going to kind of recreate the story of the story of whatever the hell happens in the Tour de France. So stage by stage, really, and we're going to have huge digressions and kind of like little sidetracks and delves into history and lots of behind the scenes footage that I'm going to film during the tour with Miller and Boardman and the rest of them. And I think there's just this kind of colossal, almost unquenchable, pent-up thirst and demand for that stuff, Tour de France-y stuff,
yeah,
in this country. And people just love lifting the curtain on kind of what the race is all about behind the scenes. And so that's going to be a celebration of all that. And it is, sounds nuts, but it's kind of, it's loads of music and loads of pictures, loads of stuff, but it is just me kind of on stage for a couple of hours with an interval in proper theatres. So that's what I do now. In my year divides between writing, broadcasting, and thesping, I suppose, is kind of like the best way of putting it.
Are you getting repeat visitors? Because if you're changing it up every year, you're getting
that's the idea.
A decent crowd.
Loyalty cards are being issued, yeah. I mean, we're trying to get it, take it around the country as much as we can, but one or two venues we keep going back to, like the City Varieties in Leeds, because it's just amazing. And,
really?
Yeah.
You get to see where there's a decent cycling scene.
Yeah, and it won't surprise you to know that Yorkshire, which of course, as we now all know, invented the Tour de France, is a real hotbed, actually.
Yeah. You must derive a different kind of pleasure from doing that, the instant feedback.
Do you know, it's terrifying. It's so unlike what we do, telly, Matt. I mean, I don't tend to get nervous. I mean, I don't know if you do. Maybe a little kind of, you get a degree of concentration.
Yeah, frisson. Yeah.
That's about as much as you ever get with telly. But honestly, I mean, I've done 40, 50 odd shows now over 2 years. And I am just a bag of nerves in the dressing room on my own.
Are you?
Pacing up and down, listening to those funny little tannoy speakers into the dressing room that relay the noise of the crowd filling up.
Are you sat there in a silk robe with your enjoying your rider, listening to Gary Newman?
Oh, that's a good idea. Gary Newman. Gary Kemp.
Gary Kemp, fellow cyclist,
exactly.
Future guest of Home Roads.
I'm sure.
Yeah. This is a remarkably hassle-free ride into
absolutely
the
lovely.
West End. It's incredible.
Hey, we just crossed over Blackfriars Bridge. And even though now, Matt, it's 10:30, so long time since rush hour has been passed, we've got like a dozen cyclists. At rush hour, 70% of the traffic across this bridge is on this cycle lane.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's heaving.
It's happening. It's happening.
We're getting close to my manor now. I use this one.
So left here, should we just go around on the embankment?
Yes.
Yeah, this is always chocker here.
Yeah.
Just up to Trafalgar Square. And then we'll just ride up the Mall.
Got to finish on the Mall.
That's kind of what the idea I had, yeah. Well, so that's it from the Queen's House in Greenwich to the Queen's current house and the Mall, Buckingham Palace. It's been good, hasn't it, Matt? I mean, like, okay, so we got snarled up there with all the traffic in Trafalgar Square, but other than that, we've just literally poodled with my England flag, which will infuriate all the kind of metropolitan cycling elite Guardian readers, but I support the England team and I don't care who knows it. But there we go. Yeah, well, not a bad place to finish. And it's once again, it's been closed to traffic. I don't know why they do this, but they do it more and more often, don't they? You can just go like this. Ooh, look at me, I'm on my bike.
They've done it for us, Ned. You know that.
Yeah.
Ned, fascinating talking to you as ever.
I think
we could talk and ride all day.
Let's
and
do it.
It would. Well, I've got things to get to.
I haven't.
Fascinating as ever.
I'm just putting off doing my prep for the tour.
Glad to be of service. Lovely talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.